Bach, organ chorale preludes arranged for piano four hands by the Hungarian composer György Kortárg. At the start there, Gotteszeit ist die allbeste Zeit, BWV 106. Then Aus tiefer Not schrei ich zu dir, BWV 687. And that last of them was Allein Gott in der Herr sei er, BWV 711. The two pianists at the one piano, both from Iceland, Víkingur Ólafsson and Anna Guðný Guðmundsdóttir. And it was part of a concert they gave in June at the Midsummer Chamber Music Festival in the Harpa Concert Hall at Reykjavík.
Drama on Three presents Votes for Women.
I don't say it wouldn't be better if men and women did this work together. But the mass of men won't have it so.
The controversial 1907 suffragette play by Elizabeth Robbins.
It would be a bad day for England if all women felt about all men as I do.
I'm going to see her.
Jean, here, follow me.
No, no.
You can get out quicker on this side.
I don't want to get out.
What? Where are you going?
To ask that woman to let me have the honour of working with her.
Votes for Women, Sunday night at 8:30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 on FM. We're on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high definition sound. It's just gone 16 minutes past nine. And now Georgia Mann introduces the last of this season's Proms Plus Late Sessions, recorded last week at the Royal Albert Hall's Elgar Room.
Good evening, and welcome to the last of this year's Proms Plus Lates. It's a sad moment. We are bidding a very fond farewell to the Elgar Room's purple lights, its shiny red piano, and you attentive, gently sipping audiences. But we are going out on a high. Oh yes, a high and soulful saxophone note this evening, no less, because rounding off the season in style for us is the Porter Quartet, who have bought their brand of explosive guitar and sax-laden jazz down the M1 from Leeds to London for us tonight. They are all graduates from the Leeds College of Music Jazz BA course, which is pretty legendary in itself now. And it's been hugely instrumental in really putting Leeds on the map as a real hub for jazz talent in the UK. Saxophonist Robin Porter formed the band, and congrats, by the way, Robin, because he earlier on this year won the George Murphy Prize for Jazz Saxophone. Not bad going. John Brown is on guitar, but like Robin, I have to say he's also a composer, so he shares those all-important compositional credits for this evening's performance. On double bass, just behind me, we have Sam Vickery, and Tom Hawthorne is on drums. And in Poets' Corner tonight. We're very pleased we have yet more Northern-based talent brought to the Proms Plus Late Table. Frances Leveston, who's come down to us from Manchester this evening, received what you might call an overwhelmingly positive response to her first collection of work, Public Dream. It was shortlisted for, deep breath, the T.S. Eliot Prize, the Forward Prize for Best First Collection, the Gerwood Albra First Collection Prize. Phew, it's not bad going at all. Tonight, though, excitingly, we're getting a sneak peek from her hotly anticipated second collection, Disinformation, where everything from the Deepwater Horizon oil spill to 24-hour news culture will be coming under her poetic lens. And we'll be hearing Frances read for us very soon. But first, kicking off our last Proms Plus Late of the season with a resounding and massive bang, it is the Porter Quartet.
We'll be right back.
Thanks, guys. That was gorgeous sounds from the Porter Quartet. Please join me, everybody, now in welcoming onto the stage this evening our poet, Frances Leveston. We're feeling quite smug because she is about to give us a sneak preview of her eagerly awaited second collection of poems, Disinformation. Frances Leveston, everybody.
Disinformation. I am making jelly for my nephew's fourth birthday party. Any flavour as long as it's red. Bouncy cubes snipped and stirred into hot water in a cloudy Pyrex dish, rediscovering the secret of isinglass, or is it horse gelatin? While a radio announcer intimates that certain unpopular facts about the operations hitherto repressed, like signs removed from crossroads and bridges in occupied lands, can now be revealed if we just stay tuned. Party bags designed to please infants pile on the counter, two bright colours badly drawn, blue napkins, party poppers. My red hands put cylinders of sausage on cocktail sticks. These pass for traditions. And all the time I listen to them talk fluently about foreknowledge, proactivity, stations. It is winter, treacherous to walk. The children are on their way by now, adults too, bundled against the promise of snow. And the entertainer with tricks and jokes, hidden under a blanket in the boot of his Volvo, limp balloons into which he will blow his lungs full of ideal animals, practices misdirection. I chop yellow cheese. Out the kitchen window, a whirligig turns, metal spokes, merciless as diagrams, cutting the air, no clothing softens. Tiny gems, icing the nodes where their lines intersect. Every extant leaf is fixed with glitter where the glue's dried clear. Thank you. So that was the title poem of the book that I've just finished, thank God. And that will be out next year. It's called Disinformation, and I think we can all probably relate to that feeling of perhaps being patronised or in some sense misled by forces larger than us, and these moments of clarity when you realise perhaps what's going on in the news isn't exactly what is going on in the world, and you sort of reach out to your own experience as an anchoring point. This next poem also touches a little bit on current affairs, or what were current affairs when I wrote the poem, which was the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. So I was reading about that. I was seeing a lot of images of that. And I felt that I wanted to write something about it. But I was also thinking a lot about one of my favourite poets, Elizabeth Bishop, a wonderful American-Canadian poet, who wrote a great deal about coastlines in Nova Scotia and Florida and Brazil, where she lived for many years. So these two things kind of combined in a strange way. So this is called Bishop in Louisiana. 12 days since I took up my post in this village, a handful of clapboard houses crowded round the harbour, and the concrete yards glittering with scales, where church groups serve up grits and tamales from long trestle tables and the interiors of white vans. I myself eat at the hotel, beef, pasta, anything but fish, watching the Black Sea break foamlessly against the chemical barricade. On its surface, orange curds ride like surfboards or children's life preservers. After dinner, I take my coffee in the privacy of my suite. There is little to accomplish here. I walk on the beach where the nests of common terns driven upwind to breed are marked by red flags mounted on popsicle sticks, hundreds of them bunting in the wind. Each nest is no more than a dint in the sand, easily made with a fist. Yesterday, I saw a dead sea turtle turning to soup inside its own shell. I am not immune to the irony of this. I write checks for the fishermen fitting their boats with booms to skim the water and speak to sad newscasters under a flypast of helicopters and a crop duster salute. Try to imagine what 100 million litres means. You can't. At night, before bed, in the surprisingly deep bath, I push my big toe into the streaming faucet and feel its pressure build to a hot, relentless gush, nightmarishly pleasurable, like pissing myself in my sleep. One more before some more of this fantastic music. This poem is a sort of paean to or reimagining of the reindeer, which I think has been misrepresented and done an injustice to by Western culture for the most part. I'm talking about you, Rudolph. And whose sort of migratory patterns have been seriously disrupted by these huge dams being built in Canada so that the rivers that they would normally cross in the winter are no longer frozen over, and sort of disaster ensues. So this is my tribute to the caribou. This is caribou. With muzzles made blue by the blue saxifrage they cultivate a weakness for, their heart-shaped chests, their little bibs, and dewlaps fringed with long white hairs like wispy radish roots, they show how thin our myths for them are. Photographed with people, they look like props, apologetically small and feminine. But homogeneous in their landscape, they make boulders shrink, and nature fits them to her fabric of snowmelt and sedge most ingeniously. There is something rabbity about them. Their soft splayed hooves and sensitive ears, that giveaway impractical tussock of a tail, spotless or mucky, signalling over plains or flashing downwards when they climb rocky outcrops in waves with a sound like knuckles cracking. Overburdened by antlers that spread like reasonable hands, all palm, all paddle, they spoon the cold air, or with one jerk rip holes in clouds the snow crowds through, corridors wolves can follow. Sometimes in spring they swim 5 miles and make the river crossing. Sometimes they drown, and their bodies bump downstream with the antlers interlocking. Young ones rub like fuzzy felts, old ones knock together with a warm, woody thunk, like a wind chime thinking. They pass their grazing grounds, they pass the wood-chipping plants and the hydroelectric, and a sleepy logger in a quilted shirt feeding denuded logs down a flume. Wherever they are going, those resinous eyes, resolutely unsoulful, don't blink or flinch. They never change at all. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was a jacket with too many pockets. It may not have sounded exactly like that, but it really was. That was the Porter Quartet. More from them very soon. Time now, then, to hear our second sequence of poems from Frances Leveson's new collection, Disinformation.
Okay, I'm going to start with a poem that's called The Historical Voice. And this poem began as a response to reading a lot of Eastern European poetry in a great anthology published, edited and published by Czesław Miłosz, the Nobel laureate, that collected loads of Eastern European poets together, like Zbigniew Herbert and Vasco Popa and Wisława Szymborska, and these kinds of people who were writing under very, very constrained, pressurised, tragic circumstances, really. And I was trying to pin down some of the qualities I liked so much in their work, and that was really where the poem came from. But I think later I realised that in speaking about the historical voice and trying to capture their poems, I was also writing about a perspective that I occasionally managed to find on my own life, usually very late at night, when there is this kind of perfect balance between compassion and judgment. It doesn't happen very often, and it doesn't last as long as I would like it to. But that's one thing a poem can do, I think, to freeze that kind of clarity for a future moment. The historical voice. The historical voice speaks when the fire's done burning, at a distance that is far but not inconceivably far from here. In its vowels, the Atlas bear and the tiger go on living. The handful of things it tells us have been said before and will be again, but it knows you're not the only person left who failed to listen. Difficult words like shame, fatigue, and dishonor take shelter in its lexicon. It can fold time, bringing two apparently unconnected matters together in combinations meant to reconfigure your sense of scale, a pin and a pinwheel galaxy, a black hole and a feather. It has no discoverable loyalties, neither male nor female, foreign nor known. Its accents come from anywhere but here. The syntax it likes is clean, perhaps translated. Rats and horses often appear, but metaphors are rarer than the similes it finds to be more true and underrated. Knowing the worst, it speaks from that shadow. We, it says, including itself, we are like this. What has occurred cannot be hidden, perhaps not understood. It tends to be more kindly than severe, more grave than good-humoured, as if in exhausted agreement that we all now comprehend the long half-life of cruelty, that love, however prone it seems, can, like a cockroach, survive most ends. It speaks like this, of love, without incurring your disfavour. People never know when to clap with poetry. I sympathise. This poem I've never read at a reading before. It's a rare kind of a poem for me. It's a poem about family. Actually, in a way, it's another poem about a kind of arrested moment, a moment of recognition. When I was young, I was quite terrified to discover that you weren't supposed to look at the sun, that it would sort of wound you and damage your eyes. I couldn't believe there was this danger just there all the time, and the only thing that would stop you from looking at it was your own willpower and sense of self-preservation. And I think that kind of terror got linked to my fear of saying anything about my family, sort of pointing out any kind of unhappiness or any problems in the family unit. So this poem came from bringing those two things together, as poems often do, kind of combining two radically unrelated subjects. So this poem is called The Eclipse. When it was time, we trooped outside, my brother, me, my parents, through the open gates and got clear of the trees, among crocuses and solemn strangers who gave sidelong looks at the sky, as if it were the end of days and they expected four horsemen or a plague of bees approaching. Patchy cows languished in the next but one field. Whatever you do, don't look directly at it, my mother said, in a tone that never changed, no matter what age the child. You'll go blind, said my brother. Nobody corrected him. Other people had made pinhole cameras out of cereal boxes. You turned your back and held the folded cardboard up so the sun shone over your shoulder like a teacher checking sums, projecting itself in a golden cone onto the screen where watching it change size posed no danger to your senses. With a shudder, I thought, what's there to stop me looking at the sun? Nothing, only this resolve in between. Then someone said, here we go. As if my shudder had escaped, a shadow began to slide across the county. It looked like a wind blowing candles out, the candles of white houses, the candles of green trees, all bright points in uniformity dimmed and left behind as the leading edge pressed on, offering no resistance. That stone sliding shut across the face of the sun shut the landscape too. It was all a projection. My mother used to show us the blood dammed in her vein by smoothing a fingertip across the back of her hand. Into that same still fascinated time, I passed when the skirt of the shadow caught me up, leeching the warmth from my scalp and face as if I had been buried in morning sand. What was dim already disappeared. I stood at the lightless center of the worst I had always feared, before the finger lifted and the force of the heart reasserting itself shot burnt sienna back into the earth. The sun's defeat made it seem less matriarchal, so I looked. Brightness clocked me in the face so hard my eyes flinched shut, but the sun in my head remained. Not yellow, not small, not even exactly there, but definitely present. Round, but not a circle, and not so much bright or shiny as intense, meltingly intense. A softness in the sky, an inwardness where common sense failed, like loose water seen through a weakness in the ice. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
And that was the last of this season's Proms Plus Late Sessions, recorded last week at the Royal Albert Hall's Elgar Room with the Porter Quartet and the poet Francis Leveston. It was introduced by Georgia Mann.
Alive with music on the BBC. The sound of horror. The sound of drama. The sound of glory. A season of programmes on TV, radio and online celebrates the sound of cinema. Starting tomorrow night at 9 on BBC 4.
And as part of the BBC's Sound of Cinema, from tomorrow you can vote for your favourite film music as chosen by a panel of movie lovers. Among the panel, presenters from BBC Radios 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 Music and the Asian Network, and film music conductor, Robert Ziegler. Between them, they've created a shortlist of 20 of the greatest ever movie soundtracks. And all you need to do is click on the links from any of the participating stations' websites, listen to all the clips and cast your vote. Voting starts at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon and it's open till midnight on the 20th of September. And the results will be played live by the BBC Concert Orchestra here on BBC Radio 3 at 2 p.m. on Friday the 27th of September. Well, back to this evening and in 45 minutes... the essay Portraits of Capa, Robert Capa, the father of photojournalism. And in this, his centenary year, five people are choosing their favourite picture by Capa and reflecting on his life and work. In the third essay tonight, Hilary Roberts of the Imperial War Museum recalls the famous D-Day portrait of a soldier floating through the waves as he lands on Omaha Beach. That's the essay at 10:45. BBC Radio 3, it's 10 o'clock now and time for Night Waves with Philip Dodd.
Jonathan, thanks very much indeed. On tonight's programme, a rather unusual Richard Dawkins in extended interview on his colonial family, on why the Bible matters so much to him and how his recent tweets on Islam have been misunderstood. Also, we have a first night review of the opening play of the new regime at the Royal Court Theatre. Is the ritual slaughter of George Mastrimus worthy of a theatre where Shaw and Brecht premiered? Well, we'll find out. And the ghostly presences of J.G. Ballard and Robert Smithson, the land artist, haunt a new film by Tacita Dean. When she and I talk, elegiac is fine, nostalgic not. But first, Richard Dawkins, recently named one of the world's outstanding thinkers in a Prospect magazine poll. It's hard to know whether he's most admired, where he is admired, for his consistent attacks on what he calls the God delusion, or for his scientific work, especially The Selfish Gene. Published in 1976, Richard Dawkins' first book argued that natural selection works at the level of the gene. Genes use human bodies as vehicles for their own survival and dispose of them, of us, when we've served our purpose. By now, we're used to his books defending science for its clarity and reason and damning religion for its irrationality, but I wouldn't have thought he was a man for a memoir. Well, I was wrong. An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist is the first of a projected two volumes. The first takes us from his childhood in Africa through public schools to his Oxford years, in effect ending with the writing and publication of The Selfish Gene. When we met earlier today, I asked him what he imagined England was like when he was an English child growing up in Africa.
I heard of England a lot, and I didn't have any clear conception what it was. I think I thought it was a great big house where my grandparents and aunts and uncles and people lived. When I first arrived in England at the age of 5, I was rather disappointed. It was cold and wet, dark, gloomy, very different from Africa.
Do you go back to Africa ever now?
Yes, from time to time. I've been back 4 or 5 times, I suppose, one way or another. I've been back to Kenya, I've been back to Malawi, which was Nyasaland when I was there. Bit of a pilgrimage to Malawi to try to find the houses where we'd lived, and succeeded in finding one, and was actually quite quite tearful about it. I mean, to find this house and see it just standing there. Pretty much the same. The bougainvillea had gone. The garden was no longer a nice garden. It had become just bare earth. It had turned into a policeman's club, oddly enough. And so it was possible actually to go in there and have a drink, rather like a pub, but especially for policemen. And the chief of police came and remonstrated because we were sitting in the private part that was reserved. That was it. I said, that's my bedroom. You can't turn me out of my own bedroom. And he was very nice about it. He had a drink with us.
When you were there when you were a child, and you were a relatively young child, so this may not be relevant, obviously you were a member of a kind of ruling elite. Your family was, just by definition of being there. There's one moment which is in parenthesis where you said you were embarrassed to remember that you called the servants boys.
Yes.
Did you have an acute sense of the kind of power differential?
It was paternalistic, patronising. I think it wasn't any more vicious than that. The sort of attitude which I imbibed as a child from the adults in the colonial service, not specifically my parents but others, was a kind of patronising, indulgent attitude towards the Africans. They were rather quaint and funny, but you couldn't really trust them to actually run anything. And they were treated rather like children. It was no accident that they were called boys, and it's one of the more dreadful things we have to live down, I think.
Before I read this book, I'd often thought of you historically, and I was trained as a historian, so you forgive the analogy. I thought of you as the T.H. Huxley of the day, you know, who famously...